David Hoberman.
Todd Lieberman.
James Bovin.
Nick Stoller.
Britt McKenzie.
Okay, so questions. Let's start down here in the corner. Oh, well, let's start in the middle. We'll get you next.
If as stated, the Muppets are enduring and loved, why did they go away? Have you guys done any kind of a...
They went on holiday.
have you done any kind of a postmortem on why they disappeared for so long?
Well, I think it's less about them having gone away and more about when... I'll just speak for myself. When I was a child back then, they were all pervasive. They had a television show. There were movies. They were all over the place. And they didn't necessarily go away as much as they kind of scaled back on how much product they put out. I think that's probably more accurate.
I think it also had to do with the sale of the company and the sort of false starts with that and being taken over, and takes time to figure out a game plan for, you know, what you want to do with a franchise once you get it.
I have a question for was there someone else?
I was just going to say, obviously, without Jim Henson, it was very hard to keep them alive.
My question is for Brett. Is there a lot of similarity between writing songs for the Muppets and the Flight of the Conchords?
Yeah, less sex jokes. but yeah, very similar.
Brett actually is a Muppet.
Yeah. I guess Jermaine was Kermit and I was Miss Piggy. But yeah, the film had very specific song placement, so I had to write them to fit new characters and everything, but it's not that dissimilar to writing for the Concord setup.
Yeah, for me, going from Concord to Muppets felt very... doing the same job, basically. It was a world of... Concourses are basically a world whereby everyone was slightly... they had a slightly weird world view, and they were all a bit...
stupid. Yeah. A little stupid.
A group of fools, maybe. And Muppets have a similar sense, that they're all very optimistic, but they're all kind of inherent failures. They're not good at what they do. And I love that about it, because you instantly feel for the underdog. And I thought that was a very similar thing with Concord's Muppets. They had a very similar tone in that sense. But also, you know, obviously in the music and the sort of innocent charm of the comedy, I felt the comedy was a very similar thing. It didn't feel that different writing for Muppets than it did for Concord. So.
No, the jokes.
It's not a very natural progression.
Yeah, the jokes would work in either.
Yeah, the jokes work for both. Well, I think she is, because she considers herself to be a great singer, and she's not a great singer, for example. And she considers herself to be a great actress, and she's not a great actress.
And a great beauty.
And I mean, I guess
which
maybe she is.
She's beautiful.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
She's beautiful. Obviously, she's beautiful. But I think it's the idea of your idea of what you are to yourself, and then what you are to other people. It's that kind of idea, I guess.
And we're over here with the mic.
Good morning. I also wanted to follow up on that last question and ask Brett about adapting your style of music from Fly the Conchords to the Muppets, and also if you could talk about portraying Animal in the film.
That's a lot of questions. I wanted to... In order for a comedy song to work, you can't have too much production in a way, because if it goes too big, you lose some of the comedy. So... within the Muppets film, it gets big, but then it also strips right back down. One of my favorite moments is when Amy Adams sings at the window, this rainy window. I don't know if you guys have seen the film, but and she does this amazing melisma and really channels her
that's
Beyonce.
That's what that's called.
And, I wanted to know that word.
And so it wasn't that dissimilar in terms of using music and comedy at the same time, using the music to support the joke or suddenly taking the music away so that the joke hits harder. Animal, we just used, as you probably all would if you were in charge of the music, to do big drum solos as much as possible.
It wasn't Brett, it was Dave Grohl.
Yeah, I didn't do the drum. I didn't play Animal.
Slight resemblance.
Yeah, quite
different
similar,
band.
To be fair.
Yeah.
We'll have two in the row in the front here.
Hi, this is for Nick Stoller. How did you conceptualize the storyline, or what was your inspiration in building the storyline?
It was basically around when Sarah Marshall came out. Jason Segel had a meeting at Disney, and they were talking about what properties he was into, and he said the Muppets. And he called me, and we very quickly wondered, it was actually related to the first question, is where have the Muppets been? Where have they been? And it seemed like a great opportunity to do like kind of a comeback movie. And from there, it very quickly developed into, like, well, what happens, what makes a group break up, what are the kind of bittersweet, you know, things that, you know, happen when a group breaks up, a group of friends or a group of, you know, in this case, the group of Muppets. And it's kind of all stemmed from that, you know, that kind of idea. So yeah.
Here in the front corner.
With the possible exception of David, none of you have known the world without the Muppets. What do you think the world would have been like if they were not here?
Am I supposed to resent that? I don't know.
He's my son. That's a great question. I don't know. I'd like to think it would be a sadder place without the Muppets. You know what I mean? I really do feel they have this great optimistic vibe about them, which is irreplaceable. I mean, I'm trying to think of things that have a similar feeling. It's like a world without Jimmy Stewart in A Wonderful Life. It's that sort of thing, you know, about the great optimism they have about themselves. And I really, well, certainly for my life, my childhood would be a far, far sadder place without them. So, yeah.
I would have had no friends as a child.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Nothing to do on Sunday afternoons either.
So, yeah.
It's a very sad thought.
Yeah, it's a hard one to really conceptualize with a world without them. But I can look at, again, going to my own children, because they weren't as familiar, or maybe actually weren't familiar at all with Kermit the Muppets. And my older son's 6 and a half, so I saw the world through his eyes of there are no Muppets, and then introducing the Muppets to him. And as these guys are saying, yes, it becomes a much nicer place when the Muppets are there, and the big smile comes on the face.
I also think, from a practical standpoint, I think there probably wouldn't be The Simpsons. I think there probably wouldn't be Pixar, like some of the Pixar movies. You know, I think that they started a kind of comedy that breaks the fourth wall and is also really heartfelt and is really witty, and but also has, like, big, you know, slapsticky things. It's kind of, you know, so I think that they really set the, you know, laid the groundwork really for a lot of comedy that's so popular.
But also importantly, I think, for a comedy that works for all age ranges. That's the amazing thing about Muppets. I think they're way ahead of their time, and that sort of idea that there's a show that could work for 4-year-olds and 60-year-olds and 30-year-olds, because when you watch it, you take different things from it, and that's what's so clever about it. And I think what a lot of people have learned from that, particularly people like Pixar, who make such amazing movies these days.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The Muppets feels like a very early version of those kind of movies.
Also, this Muppet movie wouldn't exist.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here.
So that's another problem.
Hi, good morning. How difficult were the shots?
How
difficult were the shots for the full body shots of the Muppets? Was there any CGI involved in there?
No. My simple rule was that someone had to perform something in front of camera for it to be a proper shot on my movie, because I was very keen to make sure that you had a sense that the puppets were real things you could touch, you could see the texture in their fur. The thing about the body shot, full body shots for me, is that you have to be quite judicious about where you put them in the movie. It felt like after a while that every now and then you should go to one to remind people of how they work and how they exist in the real world, because obviously otherwise you can get quite tight in on the film. It feels quite, you know, sort of almost like you're boxed in a little bit. So it's very important to judge them. And I think that after a while you get into a pattern of where they should be and how they should work. And obviously certain scenes lend themselves better to the full body shots. Like, for example, the shot of Walter under the desk is one of my favorite shots of the whole movie. And it's a beautiful thing. He feels completely real. It's a little kid under the desk, and it feels so lovely. And the other shot I love is of Scooter sweeping. It just feels, again, very natural, very real. It doesn't feel like we put it in there to show him full body. He's just doing this job whereby you want to see the broom head and his head. So those sort of things feel the best way of doing it like that.
And we're here in the middle.
This is for Nicholas. I was wondering, you write on both ends of the comedy spectrum, from like the R-rated end with Marshall and Get Him to the Greek, and then something like this or Gulliver's Travels. What do you find a hard time rating it in when you're writing for kids, or what is the difference in your process, and do you have a favorite end of the spectrum? Do you enjoy one type of comedy more than the other?
Well, for some reason, Disney made me cut out the Kermit full frontal. So that,
but he always is full frontal.
Yeah, I guess that's what they kept saying, but I'm like, we know he's really not. You know? So that was the big bummer for me. But I think it's the kind of movie it is it creates its own kind of story and its own kind of, I mean, this is, you know, its own kind of, you know, you want to be true to the, you want to be true to the material, you want to be true to the story you're telling, and there is no, at no point in writing The Muppets, you know, with Jason, did it seem appropriate to do anything that would be R-rated, you know, And, you know, like, similarly on the R-rated, you know, side of the scale, like with Sarah Marshall, there's like, you know, you can't have a breakup with a girl and or a guy and not curse at some point, you know. So, like, there was no way to do that, I thought, without it being R-rated. So I think it's just, you know, it's always becomes part and parcel of the genre and of the story you're telling.
Over here on the right.
Hi. With the fundraiser, it's kind of set up more or less like the Muppet Show was the reason for that, just because you kids of this generation.
That's an excuse to do the Muppet Show.
Yeah. well, that, and I was going to ask if that was because children of this generation aren't familiar with the Muppet Show. Was that another reason? And is there any possibility we'll get the Muppet Show again? And Miss Piggy is a beaut.
Not a question.
yes, and yes.
The telephone was always in the script from the very beginning, yeah. The idea that they'd do something. I think one of the great joys of the movie is the simplicity of the story of putting on a show again. And so I think that was always going to be in it. It grew because we liked making it, and we love songs. And I wanted to remind people, I couldn't do a movie whereby I just said the Muppets were great. I had to show them being great. This was really important to me. And so obviously one of the best ways of doing that is to do the Muppet Show, Muppet Show style sketches. And they're really fun to write, and they were really fun to shoot. And then it was just, you know, something that felt really informed people of where the Muppets were from, what they did, why they were great.
And there were discussions during the course of the development of script of, do we spend too much time in that theater at the end? And what we came to realize is that, as James is saying, you know, the fun, the excitement, the sketches, the vibe, the feel of it makes it feel bigger than just the theater.
And also for the people who know the show, it's really fun to see sort of behind the scenes of the show. Again, when Kermit goes up to say, hello, welcome to Telethon, you see that shot of him beforehand being nervous a bit, like this is the final go, you know, and I love that idea. And also, I used to always wonder, in the Muppet Show, you see Kermit behind his desk, and I always used to wonder, what does Kermit see when he sees the other way? So I love the idea we could build a theater where you'd see what Kermit used to see.
And it was also important to you to be meticulous about that opening and about the theater, and to make sure that you gave everybody the Muppet experience exactly as it was when they saw the show.
Well, it was the idea was they would do the opening to the best of their current ability. You know what I mean? It was the idea they were going to get better eventually, but this is their moment again. And it's why there are some empty holes at the top of the top row, because some of those guys went around or they forgot where they're supposed to go. You know what I mean? They were kind of making it the best effort they can, but at the same time reminding people of what that show once was.
Also, from a practical standpoint, if you need money, the only way to get money is to put on a show. So that's the other thing about that plot point. So.
All the way in the back.
Can you talk about the particular challenges of creating a new Muppet in Walter? And also, how is it that a man and a Muppet are brothers? Was one of them adopted, or is it just a strange...
Have him removed. Good question. Over to you, Nick.
My brother's actually a Muppet, so it's based on... from the beginning, Jason and I wanted there to be kind of an entry point. Sorry, I couldn't see who said that. That was felt like a disembodied voice. Oh, okay, sorry. It was like a disembodied. We wanted an entry point for people who might not be familiar with the Muppets, and we wanted a super fan. And while Jason and myself are super fans, it seemed appropriate to also have a Muppet who kind of represents the Muppet super fan and represents everything that the Muppets have really kind of lost sight of, which is their enthusiasm for, you know, for putting on shows and for, you know, doing their shows. So yeah.
And the reason he looks like he does is because very early on in the process, I asked about when you create puppets and how you build them, and I was told that the most simple puppet is basically the sock puppet, which is the one which creates the most expressions, and fundamentally what Jim made Kermit from is a sock. And so the actual facial features can change enormously and create real emotion. You can show Kermit thinking. Steve does an incredible job with Kermit where you totally feel him thinking. And so I was very keen that Walter should be of a similar simplistic build whereby he would basically be a sock puppet who can then emote as much as we need him to be us, the audience. He's the guy through which we see the movie and we meet the Muppets, and so he needs to be able to emote that much, and so that's why he looks like he does. And also, I thought he needs to be humanoid because he's his brother. It'd be weird if he was like a pet or something. It'd be very odd.
I think the idea was really, I mean, when you think about it, it's taking Henson's concept and being pretty bold with it by making them brothers, but the Muppets, and one of the beauties of the Muppets and Henson and in how he created them was the fact that they are simply accepted in our world as one of us. Nobody walks down the street, sees a Muppet, and says, "Ew, what's that?" You know, they're simply accepted. So, you know, I thought it was a bold choice on Nick and Jason's part just to put them in as brothers and accept them that way.
Here on the right.
Yes, this question is actually for Nick and for James. Regarding the big production number at the end on Hollywood Boulevard, can you talk a little bit about the logistics of that, closing down the boulevard and having that whole canvas to take care of?
Well, I wanted to do a bigger closing number to kind of round the movie off in the way we had the big opening number. Obviously, it's a reprise of Brett's brilliant song. And so I felt that after Kermit's great speech, it'd be nice to kind of spill out onto the boulevard, have this great moment there, realize they're popular again, and then sing a song about it. So I'm very keen to always cast people in that dance number who feel very real. My brief was, they mustn't look like dancers. The whole point is they're the real people of the world embracing the Muppets again. But logistically, obviously, it's a complicated thing. You have to close the whole boulevard down. We have a huge amount of crowd control. We did it in January, which is obviously a good time of year to shoot stuff.
In the middle of the night.
So it wasn't exactly tourist season, which is helpful. And it was weirdly warm. I don't know why it happened. We were very lucky with the weather. We got two warm nights in a row, which is amazing for January. Had it been cold, the whole thing could have been very much smaller and shorter. But luckily it was a great weather, so it was, you know, it was one of those things. You just deal with what's in front of you day by day on a shoot. And we were way into it by then. We were on like day 40. So by that time, so whatever turned up, you dealt with, got moved on. You know, so it wasn't one of those things you had much time to think about. But And we had the great help of Michael Rooney, the choreographer, had a very clear idea that I would make the Hollywood Boulevard itself like the proscenium of a theater, and the width of the road would be the front of the stage, and we'd make a shoot it that way and make it very clear that's what it would look like. And we, obviously, I block it out, and we have rehearsals, and I storyboard it, so everyone knows what they're doing, because they have to, because they have a huge amount to achieve in, you know, hardly any time at all.
I also have to say, as a producer, one of the great experiences is to be able to shut down Hollywood Boulevard in front of Grauman's Chinese and do a huge musical dance number.
But oddly enough, when we were doing it, we hadn't realized this yet. We shut down the whole street, and we all looked up, and there was this big banner celebrating Jim Henson.
Yeah.
And it kind of felt like we were supposed to be there at that time.
It's true. You'll see it in the movie. It's actually there on the left.
We didn't place it there.
No,
it was just there.
He was getting a Hollywood Walk of Star fame, I think, and then Wolf Fame Star. And he was just there looking down, which is very nice.
Right here in the front row.
I also have a musical question, so it's a good follow-up. Can you guys talk about revisiting some of those great old Muppet songs, like Rainbow Connection in particular? How did you decide what old songs needed to be brought back, and how did you integrate them into the new ones?
Well, in terms of which ones, Rainbow Connection was an obvious choice, because if you're going to put Muppets back together again, they're going to sing that song. And in terms of the staging of it, I always loved the idea they'd do a theatrical version of the first movies. You know, Kermit's on a log, you know, Don DeLuise comes in a boat, but it's Piggy this time. You know, you remember, if you know the movie, you know that scene. I always thought Rainbow Connection would work, and that would be a great moment. And then other than that, was just kind of then to Brett was like, how would that sound as a live show with all the Muppets joining in as a great unity moment whereby, in the movie, obviously, it's just Kermit singing that song, which is lovely. But I thought for this, it would be nice if they all kind of joined in, which is kind of they're all back together again.
And we were pretty, it was a pretty traditional arrangement. We just tried to respect the original.
Yeah, I mean, we love Paul Williams, so I was very pleased the other day when he saw it and he said how much he liked it. That meant a lot to me.
Here in the front row on the right.
Hi there. It's fantastic that some of the, you've got a whole new bunch of performers and Muppeteers coming through, but you're very lucky to also be working with Steve Whitmire and, you know, Dave Goles, the original Muppeteers from the Muppet movie, from Muppet Show. Mm-hmm. What was it like working with them, and did they give you much creative input? Because, of course, they'd be the ones that would know the most about the Muppet spirit.
Sure.
Okay, so something?
Yeah,
I didn't realise Dave was an original Muppeteer when I first started working. I was like, what's up with this guy? Well, he doesn't sound right. And then they were like, shut up, Brett, he's the original guy. But it was great because, you have the voice of authority and experience, and they sort of gave it a lot of weight and integrity. And it was, I mean, his Gonzo, it really sounds like Gonzo.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
They were incredibly useful, as you imagine them to be. You know, they know the characters so well. And so, you know, they know what they're talking about as you listen to them, you know. And it was really very useful having them around. They were great. I mean, you know, Steve's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's different for, you know, fans, even super fans coming into something like this, juxtaposed with the people who've been living it forever. So there might be some things that we wanted to do that maybe didn't completely coincide with what the characters are. And so there was a useful collaboration, almost like you're dealing with essentially the stars of your movie, and they're talking about, here's what my character would do in this scene. And, you know, it is very useful information.
There's also, from a script writing standpoint, there are a lot of rules of the world that we didn't understand and that they explained to us. And you know, in original drafts, Walter and Jason and Gary, Gary was a ventriloquist and Walter was his puppet, and they did this amazing act on the Venice boardwalk. That was our original. And they were like, in this world, you know, as David said earlier, in this world, the Muppets are people. No one mistakes them for a puppet. And so it was rules like that that make, you know, make the world kind of work.
I was amused when we were recording. There's a big number with, you know, lots of Muppets singing, and I was like, okay, and the chickens? Like, oh, the chickens can't sing. They can't talk. Like, okay, but for every other animal can talk, but chickens can only cluck. Okay, guys, all right, let's chickens it is.
In the back.
I have a question, but I also have a confession. I didn't actually know that the Muppets broke up. I didn't know the chronology of it. And I don't suspect that my listeners will, or a percentage of my listeners won't either. So from the voice of the experts, what's the chronology? I didn't know they'd been sold either. So could you connect some dots?
Do you mean the real world of the movie?
I mean in the real world.
Right,
can you connect some dots for me so I can best tell your story when they ask me and I don't sound like a Muppet?
In the real world, they never really broke up. That's just in the movie. In the real world, they have moved around a bit in terms of who has ownership of the brand, the Muppets. But they never broke up. They've been doing stuff ever since, you know, since the beginning, 74. They've been consistently making movies and making TV specials. But in terms of who owns them, that has changed from the Henson Company to a German company for a while. I mean, it's not my area of expertise.
I briefly owned them for a week.
And then I think Brett had them for a while.
We do differentiate the movie from the real world. In the real world, as James said, they didn't break up. They've been doing movies, TV, commercials, you know, personal appearances. So that's just our film.
It was our creative license in slightly exaggerating the idea that the first person asked the question of where have they been. I mean, it's just that they were so everywhere several years ago, and then they've been around, just not as much. So it was our kind of creative license to exaggerate that point for dramatic effect.
Yes.
Bless you.
Well, that's because they simply, I think that's mostly due to the fact that there haven't been movies or a television show.
Isn't it something like people under 26 didn't grow up with the Muppets? So, because I got younger friends who, I was like, I'm doing the Muppets, and they were like, oh, is that Miss Piggy? Like, they really didn't know, they don't know the characters.
Yeah, some people are much more familiar with Muppet Babies, for example, which came afterwards. It just depends.
So it's been 20 years since they've had any real presence in the media.
And we'll have time for one final question here in the front.
The puppeteers that voice the Muppets are so clever, and I was wondering, did you allow them to ad lib at all? Because they can be hilarious. And also I wondered for you, James, if it was at all limiting, because you have Muppets on the screen and there's just so much they can do.
Sure. Well, the first question I asked about this job was, you know, how it works, because I didn't really know. I mean, I came to this because it's a complete ingenue. I didn't know anything about it. And the most important thing I learned immediately was that the guys who perform the puppets also do the voices, and they do them live, so therefore they can improvise. So you have a scene with Jason and Kermit can, or Walter, they can say whatever they like. And that is incredibly important, because obviously for me, coming from a comedic background, a large amount of my work has been improvisation. Now, saying that, on this movie it was harder because of the time restrictions, and obviously the puppets is quite a long, lengthy process of shooting, so there wasn't as much opportunity as maybe that you can get sometimes. But at the same time, they are completely free to do whatever they want to do, and often it was like, you know, we just make stuff up on the spot, and it would really work really well, particularly in reactions to situations or within the show itself, the idea of the show being a sort of hubbub, stuff going on all the time. That was very useful. It was great. And to me, in terms of restricting, not really, because even in how I shot it, I always set out with an idea of what I would do were they just real, and then from there on we'd work with Puppet Captain Bill Beretta or my DP Don Burgess and work out how we'd achieve that. And so the movie really looks like how I wanted it to look. Well, I never felt like, oh, this has to be like this or this is this. It was very much the thing. It is the movie I think it is. As a sense, I feel that it's quite expansive. It feels big, which is what I love about it. Because obviously with puppets, you've got the danger of being very small. And so I hope you guys think the same.
and just to add also, in every movie you do, you know, ADR at the end when you're putting, you know, lines on back of actors' heads to make scenes work that may be filling in jokes or holes or gaps. And we all kind of went in with the idea that, well, they're just kind of puppets. They're doing this, so we can kind of put anything in their mouth when we want to. And the challenge of that, obviously, is that every time they do this, you have to pick the exact kind of syllable to fit the mouth. So the ADR that we did at the end of this movie was very useful, too, but it posed its own challenges.
Yeah, I got very good at writing specific kind of words to match lip flaps. So basically, like, you know.
Punch lines to specific syllable count.
Exactly.
Thanks, also, everybody. I just want to say that all of us, as soon as we started working with the Muppets and the puppeteers, gained an enormous amount of respect for what they do, how they do it, their art, their gift, their talent. It's an
their
extraordinary thing that they're
their arms.
Yeah, big, huge biceps here, nothing here.
Yeah. Especially the guys with the big one. The big Muppets are very heavy, and, you know, people like Bill.
Yeah, it's a difficult, difficult thing to do, and we were all just blown away by how they do it and working with them from the get-go.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.